The last day dawns on the kingdom of Ascalon. It arrives with no fanfare, no tolling of alarms. Those who will remember will speak fondly of the warm morning breeze.
Scribe?
Yes, my lord?
These char are relentless, but we shall hold the wall at all costs.
Yes, my lord.
Take this message to Sir Titus. Go forth and recruit the strongest, the smartest. Bring to me the bravest in all of Ascalon. Find me the heroes who will lead our kingdom to glory.
As you command, my lord, I will tell them all about Guildcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the 70th episode of Guildcast for April 28th, 2007. I'm your host, Sean. You know what today is, right? Of course you do. It's the second anniversary of the official launch of Guild Wars. In honor of this occasion, ArenaNet has a second birthday celebration going on this weekend with parties, little birthday cakes, and new two-year mini pets. I also have a segment later on in this show, submitted to me by Goose, or Big Daddy Goose, as he calls himself. He's going to go over the basics of inventory in his Back to the Basics segment we're trying out for this episode. So, whether you like it or you hate it, let us know in the forums. But as far as this episode's theme goes, it's something that I've always loved myself, and that's pre-searing Ascalon in Chapter 1. I'm going to talk about everything from the storyline of pre-searing, an overview of pre-searing's quests and features, the tight, hardcore pre-searing community, and probably one of the most difficult titles to get in the game, and that's the Legendary Defender of Ascalon title for reaching level 20 in pre-searing. I wanted to thank Infinity Paradox and Captain Donut for their help with this episode, as well as everyone at pre-searing.com, which I'll mention again later in more depth. Infinity Paradox also came up with the idea of making a show about the Legendary Defender of Ascalon title, and since I've always wanted to make a pre-searing episode, and I've always had that in the back of my mind, I thought this would be a good opportunity to join the two ideas together in one show. So let's get into the people who asked to be mentioned this episode. They include Yoroichi Stonevale and Knight of Aphrodite, or as we all know him better, as Chiyo. Before I get into the news this week, though, I wanted to mention something special that we're going to be doing this summer. During the week of June 25th, 2007, I'll be in San Francisco, California for a vacation. During this time, Cal Agram will also be out there for a vacation, and we all know that Lady Sinea already lives in that area, so I figure what better time and place to have our first official Guildcast meet and greet. So I'll announce the exact time and place very soon, probably on the next episode or the one after, because we haven't really decided an exact time or date or location yet, but it'll be between June 25th and 27th. It'll probably be somewhere downtown San Francisco, I guess. So if you live in that area or within driving distance and would like to come out and meet us in the flesh, then this is the time to do it. I'm pretty excited about this myself, and I really hope we can meet many of you in person. Now for the news. Of course, there have been some tweaks to hard mode, which Cal and I talked about last week. Soon after we recorded that show, ArenaNet changed a few things, namely the loot scaling that we were talking about. Now, it still works with gold as far as only getting the allotment that you would have based on the maximum party size, but some certain items have gone back to the old way of being dropped, not dependent on the party's max size. Now, these items include skill tomes, scrolls, dye, rare materials such as ectoplasm, gemstones from the Domain of Anguish, all other rare gold items, all unique green items, and special event items. They also added the Warrior's 15K Knight's Armor set to the Crafter in Marhan's Grotto. So go out there and check that out, because I think it's a pretty nice set. I especially like the leggings, but, you know, I guess to each his own. And then finally on this update, they did something that was actually unannounced, and that was the change to the pet's attack range. So you can now actually send them into attack from about twice the range of the aggro bubble or closer. So, like, before you had to actually hit the target to get the pet to attack, but you don't have to do that anymore, which that comes in pretty handy. And then there was an update on April 26th where they messed with the lock picks a little bit. And what they do now is they give players 250 points towards their lucky title if they successfully retain a lock pick after use, and 25 points towards the unlucky title if the lock pick breaks. They also started introducing the 2-year birthday mini pets this weekend. So far, these include miniature versions of the Fire Imp, Kurzik Juggernaut, Wind Rider, Stone Axe Hecate, Mandragore Imp, Harpy Ranger, Bladed Atax, or however you pronounce that, Atix, whatever, Thorn Wolf, Palawa Jocko, Koss, Winter's Day Elf, the Undead Lich, Water Djinn, which I really want, and the rarest of them all, a Mini Gwen. I'd almost consider this episode one mainly for beginners, as, you know, I'm going to go over some of the really basic things from early on in Chapter 1, but I've also thrown in a hefty amount of advanced stuff that you may not have even realized the first time or times that you've played through pre-searing. I'd also hope that this episode will convince the people who may have entered the Guild Wars world at Chapter 2 or 3 to run out and get Chapter 1 because of what I consider to be the best tutorial area in all three chapters, hands down. Some people opt to create their characters in Kanta because of the quick leveling potential, or in Alona because it's the newest, and it also is pretty good for quick leveling. Or sometimes they stay away from Tyrion-born characters just because of the fact that you get your extra 2 15 attribute quests much later on in the game, and they're really harder quests overall. But, you know, to me, pre-searing Ascalon outweighs all of those other options. So if you're looking to create a new character soon, and maybe you haven't really been back to pre-searing in a long time, or maybe you've just recently gotten into Guild Wars and you have yet to make a character in Prophecies, then I hope that this episode will convince you to make your next character Tyrion-born. Pre-searing Ascalon is the beginner or tutorial area of Chapter 1 Prophecies. This is where all of your veteran players, including Lady Sinea and I, got our first tastes of the Guild Wars universe. This area holds so much sentimental value for me. Even today when I play my pre-searing character, I see things that remind me of almost 2 years ago and the thoughts that were going through my head discovering this gorgeous new game. The name Pre-Searing comes from the fact that this is the Kingdom of Ascalon before it was burnt to a crisp by those pesky char. The trees are lush, the grass is swaying in the light breeze, and even the lighting is luminescent and calming. It's the perfect fairy tale setting that ArenaNet developed quite convincingly to make us feel right at home here. This also plays into the despise that we'll have for the char later on in the game, when we find out that they're responsible for devastating our beautiful homeland. But let's not think about that right now. Let's concentrate on the soothing beauty of pre-searing Ascalon. The monsters you'll first encounter in pre aren't initially aggressive. You'll notice that you can pretty much walk right up to a river scale or a grawl wandering just outside of the city, and they'll completely ignore you. Actually, they'll walk around you if you stand in their way. This is something I didn't realize at first. As I saw a red dot on my radar map, I'd just run over and attack it at once, no questions asked. Now, they don't actually start getting aggressive towards you until you see the ones that are about level 2 or higher. Pre-searing is the place where you'll want to get your initial skills through quests and also pick your second profession. It's the place where you're going to meet many of the key characters that will play a huge role in all three chapters, like Menlo and Sin, plus others that play important roles in the Prophecy storyline, like Prince Rurik and Lady Althea. and you also find some future henchmen like Little Tom, Devona, and Orion. And then, of course, we have Gwen, who is rumored to make a grand appearance in the next expansion, Eye of the North. There are a total of 58 quests in pre-searing, and this includes all of the ones for secondary professions, but there are only a handful that you really need to do to leave pre-searing quickly. Now, I can't imagine why you'd want to leave such a gorgeous part of the game so quickly, so I won't go over that. Now, as for the areas of pre-searing, you'll start out in Ascalon City, which is the main city in pre-searing. When you walk outside, you're in Lakeside County, which is also home to Ashford Abbey, right down the road to the southwest. To the northwest, we have Green Hills County, which is the home to the Berrydin Estate and many, many Grawl. To the south of Green Hills County is Wizard's Folly, which is it's a more mountainous area, and it has some snowy regions to it. And this also contains the small outpost known as Foible's Fair. From these three areas I just named, from Green Hills County, Lakeside County, and Wizard's Folly, you can access the Catacombs, which is an underground explorable area filled with undead and poisonous water. It was once the sacred burial place used by Ashford Abbey, but once it was overrun by the undead, it was soon abandoned. Now, if we continue in a clockwise direction from Wizard's Folly, we get to Regent Valley in the southeast, which is my favorite area of Guild Wars. If I were to choose a place to live anywhere in the Guild Wars world, Regent Valley would be the place. It's a little more hilly and covered in trees and forests than the rest of pre-searing Ascalon, and it's also the home to the prestigious Fort Rannoch. This leaves one more explorable area to mention, the Northlands. To reach here, a party of two is required. You need one person to open the locked gate, which blocks the portal, and you need another person to actually run through the portal once the gate is open. It's impossible for one person to open the gate and then run through the portal before the doors close again, and that's because the lever to open the gate is actually on top of the wall. Now, the Northlands are where the most advanced and highest level creatures roam, the Char, who will actually go on to cause the destruction or searing of all of Ascalon. So now that you know a little bit about the area, let's talk about the community of pre-searing. Now, I'm not talking about the casual players who create a character there, then leave a few levels later. I'm talking about the people who live and breathe pre-searing. The people who have reached level 20 there, or are well on their way. These are the regulars that you'll see dancing on the steps of Ascalon City, American District 1, or European District 1. These are the people at pre-searing.com. Now, I wasn't asked to mention this website or anything like that. I've just found this site to be exceptionally well done for the niche that it serves, which is the hardcore pre-searing community. I asked some questions in a forum post there for the Legendary Defenders of Ascalon title holders to give you guys some tips on obtaining the title. I'll read those questions and answers at the end of the next segment, which is all about how to reach the Legendary Defender of Ascalon title. The Legendary Defender of Ascalon title, as I mentioned earlier, is probably the hardest title to get in Guild Wars. It involves a very precise method of gaining experience through death leveling and without the use of quest rewards until the very end. I'm going to read from a guide on guildwiki.org with step-by-step instructions on the best method of reaching level 20 in pre. This is, of course, a basic run-through, but if you have specific questions regarding death leveling or any of the more advanced aspects, I invite you to check out the guides and articles on pre-searing.com. Those folks have compiled some interesting stats, including some figures on exactly how many char you need to kill at what level, and, you know, things like that. A lot of math and stats, which are really interesting. One thing I ask of you, though, as Guildcast listeners, is please, please, please respect this pre-searing community and the time that they've already put into their research. They have this site and forum set up to help people. But if you go on there and you make a post saying something like, "Hi, I just started a character today, how do I death level?" It will not only embarrass yourself, but it will also not exactly get you off on the right foot with these people. Now, I'd really just recommend that you go on there and you read through their guides and you read through their forum. They even have a whole board dedicated to death leveling itself, so you know, read through that. They're really a friendly bunch of people, and they understand the dedication that it takes to achieve this title. The most important thing to understand if you want to start working on this title is how the experience gained from killing monsters decreases as your character gains level. So let's go over this step by step. First, you may start any and all quests, especially to unlock skills given up front or in the process of a quest. And you may even complete the quest, but do not claim the reward until you reach at least level 16, preferably level 19. The quest can actually sit in your log marked as complete, but just don't talk to the final person to claim your reward. This is very important. The only exceptions to this rule are your very first quest for your two first skills that you get, such as, like, if you're a warrior, you talk to Van the Warrior, or if you're a monk, you talk to Siglo the Monk, or, you know, so on. But it is advantageous to wait until level 19 instead of any earlier, because when you begin death leveling, then you won't need to wait as long for the monsters to become the same level as you are, or higher. And take note that some quests cannot be completed without claiming the reward. And these quests should be abandoned and postponed, especially if quest items occupy a valuable slot in the inventory, which happens with a lot of these pre-serian quests. Since you only have, you know, you're going to have your belt pouch, and that's pretty much it, especially for quite a while, as far as your inventory, your bag and your belt pouch, you have a really limited amount of inventory slots. So don't waste them with stuff like you know, the beautiful feather or other quest items that you can find laying around. Just abandon the quest and you can always go back and get those later when you're level 19. Fight your way to level 16 solely by killing monsters. Most foes in pre-searing are level 3 or less. You may climb to level 7 or so quite fast by killing level 3 foes, such as black bears, blood-sworn bandits, and ice elementals in Wizard's Folly. Indeed, there is a trail of black bears and bandit blood sworns just northwest of Foible's Fair. After killing them, follow the path between Foible's Fair and Lakeside County and proceed west once you pass the house. There should be a portal to enter the catacombs from there. Use this to respawn the enemies as necessary. It's recommended to do this until level 7 or 8. There are some higher level foes in pre-searing as well. Like, there's an adult drake in the river outside of Ascalon itself, and a warrior boss skeleton in the dead end above the pit in the catacombs. Or there's also a bull that's level 5 right outside of Ascalon down by a lake. And that's actually what I use for quite a few of the levels on my pre-searing character. An effective method to finish or earlier speed up the climb to level 11 is by repeating the quest Char at the Gate and abandoning it every time it's completed. The foes are level 5 and Prince Rurik and his forces beat them easily while healing you effectively if you join in. Just make sure that you have the foes in your danger zone in order to actually collect the experience. And then you map back to Ascalon and abandon the quest immediately so you don't accidentally accept the reward, which is actually what I did. Now, another way to do this, to make the process speed up just a little bit at the cost of one kill's experience and possibly a drop, is by map traveling back to Ascalon City while one char remains alive. This saves the whole step of needing to abandon the quest and then go back to Rurik to get it again and all that. This is done via a small bug where Prince Rurik will only move while you are in his danger zone. With practice, it's possible to leave him behind just before the battle against the char, but bring his troops with you. Without Rurik, they are considerably weaker offensively, giving you time to map travel back at the appropriate time. This, like I said, takes a lot of practice. And then from level 11 on, you'll actually have to go into the Northlands to kill the Char, who are level 7 and above. Then when you get up to level 14, you must get your experience from killing the level 10 Char bosses. That's the only way you're going to get experience. And the Char bosses are all together on this platform that's probably about midway, maybe a little bit farther into the Northlands. You'll see it. And then once you reach level 16, this is where you have to start using the death leveling method, which I'll go over in a second. And at level 19, that's when you can actually claim all of your rewards. And you get the experience for all your quests, including all quests from all secondary professions. That's very important too. Don't pick a secondary until you do every single quest. You know, you go through, you get a secondary quest, you do all the quests that are associated with it, but you don't actually accept that secondary, and then you move on to the next secondary and do that again. And you can do this with all 58 quests. As long as you have the quest in your quest log, you may complete it and collect the reward at any time. But be sure that you have all the profession quests in your quest log before accepting your secondary profession once and for all. Now let's talk about death leveling. This is a topic that is a lot of people don't understand it, and it's really quite fascinating, actually, if you think about it. But it is a key part to becoming level 20 in pre-searing. Actually, it's the only way you can become level 20 in pre-searing. Due to the fact that you don't gain experience from killing foes that are more than 5 levels lower than you, and the fact that the highest level foes in pre-searing are level 10, the only way to climb higher than level 16 is by death leveling. This involves leveling an opponent monster by allowing it to kill your character over and over again, typically while the player is AFK. The monster gains experience from this and levels up. The monster must be located near a resurrection shrine in order not to lose aggro before you respawn. Once the monster reaches an appropriate level, preferably level 20, at least your own level minus 5, then it can be killed for experience. Remember, there is no death penalty in pre-searing, so this works well. Monsters commonly used for this method are Striders in Ashford Village and Moss Spiders near Baradin's Estate. It's also possible to lure the Char Patrol in the Northlands close enough towards the Res Shrine to death level them, but it's a bit tricky not to lose aggro. You can speed up the frequency of being killed, and consequently the experience gained by the foe, by removing all armor to reduce your AL, also aggroing more than one foe at a time, but only one of them will level up. You can also wield a vampiric weapon, giving yourself a negative 1 health degeneration. But as of April 2006, exactly a year ago, they no longer drop in pre-searing, but can be purchased from people who found drops before the update. Now these are becoming so rare and so expensive. You can also do a repeated life sacrifice, which means you can't go AFK. Also using this warrior skill Frenzy will cause you to take double damage, and repeatedly activating the warrior skill Heal Signet just before getting struck and then canceling it with the escape key after being struck causes you to have negative 40 armor without getting healed, but that seems about the most tedious way to do it right there. Also, take note that after 10 hours of no activity at all by yourself, like if you don't move, you don't press the keyboard, no input at all, then you will automatically be disconnected from the server with an error 059. This is something that they just started doing a couple months ago. And also beware that sometimes after 24 hours, you will get kicked off the game regardless. As a side note, if you want to train a rarer pet along with you while going for this title, like a black bear, which is probably the hardest one to get in pre-searing, and you want to have Ranger as your secondary profession, take Master Ranger Nente's quest and tame the Blandur Stalker, complete the quest without actually accepting the reward, get rid of the Stalker, proceed to tame the pet of your choice, while keeping the completed quest in your log, and then finally accept the reward when you're level 19. That's a good way to have a pet with you. Now, there's been debates whether having a pet with you when you death level is actually a good thing or a bad thing. Some say it doesn't matter. Some say it's actually bad for you in case they only attack the pet. Personally, I have a pet with me. I haven't gotten to the point of death leveling yet, but I just like having a pet with me so far. Now, also remember, there's no way to actually get both a Survivor and Legendary Defender of Ascalon title. It's just impossible to let a partner do the death leveling for you, since a party will only be resurrected at a resurrection shrine if all party members are dead. And since there's no resurrection skill other than the resurrection signet, and no more than 4 morale boosts in one area, you can't resurrect your partner enough to level up an enemy to an acceptable level. Pets can be resurrected repeatedly with Comfort Animal, though, but they don't give experience to the foe after their first death. The highest possible level you can reach and still have 0 deaths in pre-searing is level 17, except for primary elementalists and mesmers, because all of the quests' XP would still leave you at level 16 and 99% experience. Now, whoever figured that out has way too much time on their hands. Also, a note about this LDOA title is it's the only title that's available exclusively to native characters of one campaign, because Canthan or Alonian characters can't access this title. And if you own the Game of the Year edition, or if you buy the Game of the Year add-on from the NCSoft store, this actually enables characters to acquire max damage weapons and max armor, like shields, with the slash bonus command. And this is really helpful. A lot of people who are going for pre-searing only characters, they go ahead and spend that extra $5 for the Game of the Year add-on bonus and weapons. Also, another tip is if you set your pet to heal, it will prevent it from attacking, which will prevent it from killing your foe before you're ready to do so yourself, and it will give your foe a small amount of experience. Additionally, since high-level foes will generally kill you several times while you're working on killing them, having a pet limits the amount of time that they spend healing while you're dead, as they'll actually be busy attacking the pet and won't have time to gain the natural health regeneration. Now, let me just go over this again. I know I read a lot of this, and might have been kind of confusing. But let me just go over the basics of this, in case you're a little lost. Because you have to grasp how insane this title actually is, and how dedicated these people are who actually get this title. Okay, you basically spend all of your time killing level 3 and level 5 monsters, up until about level 11. And then the only way you can gain experience then is you go kill the char bosses up in the Northlands. Okay, well, that doesn't sound too bad, right? I mean, you can go there and you can kill them over and over again, and it may take quite a while, quite a few weeks, depending on how long you play, but that's the way to do it. And then when you get level 16 is when you do the death leveling. Death leveling, you go, you aggro a group of char, you bring them back to the res shrine, which is actually the one towards the beginning entrance to the Northlands. So you have to keep their aggro. You know, you try to bring them back, you try to pull them, and they're just going to run back away. So that's quite a project in itself, just getting them back to the res shrine. So you have to do that. Then you get them to the shrine, and you have to let them kill you over and over again. And then you respawn at the shrine, and then while they're killing you over and over again, that's how they level, so that they get up to a certain level, and then once you kill them, you get whatever experience it is, like a couple hundred experience, maybe not even that, depending on what level you are, from killing this char. And the time it takes them to level while killing you is hours and hours and hours. I mean, you can go to work or school and come back, and basically that's what you do. You set them up, like say you're going to go to school, you bring the char back to the Red Shrine, you let them kill you, you go to school, come back 8 hours later, the char are probably, you know, level 17, 18, whatever, depending on what level you are. You kill them once, you get a couple hundred experience, again, depending on your level, and then you do it again, probably before you go to bed. You do this over and over again, day in, day out, And it's just a couple hundred experience each time. And once you, you know, the higher level you are, the less experience you get. So the more times you have to do this. That's just how crazy this death leveling actually is. So I actually went in and I went to priestsearing.com and I asked a few of the hardcore priestsearing members a couple questions. I made a post in there and I'm going to actually read each of their responses. There were six questions. I asked seven questions, but the first one was, what's your name? So I won't read that one because I'll tell that one. But I'm going to read the answers to the six questions that I asked them. I find it really interesting, the differences of opinion on some of these answers. So let's start with the first one, who is Sylvia La Duchesse. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And they're a mesmer who have only been around the character for 3 months now. So I asked, is this your only character with the LDOA title? And their response was, yep, this was the challenge I was giving myself. I was wondering if I'd be able to get this title. That, and also, that I wouldn't ever go for this title again on another character. I can imagine. So the question number two, do you have characters throughout the rest of the game or other chapters? Yeah, 8 other characters. One of every profession except Ranger. All PvE characters, almost all maxed out. With the best weapons they can get, 15k armor, every skill of their professions and elites. My warrior is my title hunter. I currently have 14 max titles on her. Only one more for I'm very important. If only I had LDOA or Legendary Survivor on her. Question number 3. What do you love most about pre-searing? The atmosphere. The looks. There is no other area in the game that can match how nice pre-searing looks. In Guild Wars Eye of the North, however, we've learned that we're going into the Char homeland, which resembles a lot like pre-searing. Question 4. What was the hardest level to reach in pre-searing and why? Hard question. The most tiresome level is from level 15 to 16, because you have to kill Char bosses over and over. That means going to town, begging for someone to open the gate for you, waiting for that person to leave so you can solo the bosses and get more experience, if he ever leaves, running to the bosses, killing one or two patrols to have the path clear to the bosses, then lure a boss and kill it, hoping that you won't draw the attention of the Char healer and get in even more trouble. And then you lure and kill the rest. Then you go back to town and repeat. It's about 10 to 15 minutes a run, which you have to do for about 82 times. It's quite fast, though, compared to death leveling, but it's much more tiresome. Question 5. Do you think the LDOA title is good or bad for the hardcore pre-searing community? Well, that's a strange question. I'm pretty sure LDOAs are the hardcore pre-searing community. I don't see how LDOA can be a burden, though. Number 6. What advice would you give to people seeking the LDOA title? Only try to get this title if you are sure you want to spend an incredibly huge amount of time in it and can let your computer stay connected for 10 hours plus a day for death leveling. And the next set of answers I got was from the pre-legend, who actually isn't level 20 yet, but I thought it'd be a good idea to read some of his answers since he's actually on his way to level 20. So question number 1, is this your only character with the LDOA title? Currently level 16, going for the LDOA title at 23% and rising daily. Question 2, do you have characters throughout the rest of the game or other chapters? Yes, I have 3 accounts, post account, pre account, and other account. What do you love most about pre-searing? It's so relaxing and so laid back, not all uptight, and it doesn't have a gotta beat the game mood. Number 4, what was the hardest level to reach in pre-searing and why? Going from level 13 to 14 because you're not that good to solo yet and you barely get any experience from monsters. Question number 5, do you think the LDOA title is good or bad for the hardcore pre-searing community? I think it's bad. People are just in pre to get that title, and pre's not all about the title. It's about having fun. The title is just something you do in your free time. And question number 6, what advice would you give to people seeking the LDOA title? Don't give up, you'll make it eventually, and when you do, don't brag about it to people. Now the next person we have is Leet Fire with his answers. Question number 1, is this your only character with the LDOA title? He says, currently the only character, but I'm working on another one that's level 17 at the moment. Question 2, do you have characters throughout the rest of the game or other chapters? He says he has all 3 campaigns and characters throughout. Question 3, what do you love most about Pre-Searing? The serene surroundings, and it offers a little diversion from the harder parts of the game. Question 4, what was the hardest level to reach in Pre-Searing and why? He says going from level 15 to 16. It's a long haul, only 128 experience per boss run. Monotonous after a while, takes lots of patience. Do you think the LDOA title is good or bad for the hardcore Pre-Searing community? I think it's great for the Pre-Searing community. Something lofty to work toward, and it does take a lot of work. And finally, question 6, what advice would you give to people seeking the LDOA title? He says, be patient. You will go nuts if you are in a hurry. Take breaks every now and then to break up the monotony. You'll have it before you know it. And next we have Kwang Mushou, who I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who is a monk elementalist from the LDOA Guild, who I believe is run by God Antipowers. I'm not positive though, but God Antipowers is one of the first people ever to become level 20 in Pre-Searing, back before there was even a title for it. Anyway, here's his answers. I asked him, is this your only character with the LDOA title? And he says, currently, the only character with the LDOA title is Kwang Mushou, but Master Mushou, my warrior, is level 13, working towards the LDOA. Question number 2, do you have characters throughout the rest of the game or other chapters? And he says, I have multiple characters that have completed all 3 chapters of the game. Some are working through different parts of different chapters, and currently I have 3 in Pre-Searing. Question 3, what do you love most about Pre-Searing? He says, the kicked back and relaxed feel of Pre-Searing is what keeps bringing me back to it. It has that small town feel. The hustle and bustle of post, the big city feel, can begin to burn you out. Question 4, what was the hardest level to reach in Pre-Searing and why? Level 20 was the hardest for me to reach. I finished the entire quest log early because LDOA wasn't actually available at the time, which meant I had to death level all the way through level 19 without the rewards of the quests to speed me along. So he pretty much did it the hard way, but like he said, that was before the title was even available. Question number 5, do you think the LDOA title is good or bad for the hardcore Pre-Searing community? He says, LDOA is definitely good for Pre-Searing. The community has grown, activity has increased, and the economy is booming. I'm hoping with all this growth, ANET will notice and increase activities in Pre. Because of the renewed interest in Pre, we are in the process of forming a char hunt contest. It's to see who can clear the char from beyond the North Gate the quickest. Currently, there is also a modeling contest going on that has drawn an amazing amount of interest. Both contest information can be found at www.pre-searing.com. And finally, question number 6. What advice would you give to people seeking the LDOA title? He says, LDOA is a long haul, so be patient. Ask questions and seek help from the community. We are very helpful and willing to show new title seekers the ins and outs. And finally, the last set of answers was from someone who was recommended to me highly by everyone I talked to as an extremely nice person and also the admin for Pre-Searing.com. Her character's name is Nursing Assistant, and she says that this is her only character with the LDOA title, and she has another character who is close to finishing all 3 campaigns. So then I asked her, what do you love most about Pre-Searing? And she said, I would have to say, my friends. Almost every hardcore Pre-Searing player knows one another. Next, I asked, what was the hardest level to reach in Pre-Searing and why? And she says, level 15 and beyond, because you need to death level to gain any experience. On the way to level 20, you'll encounter errors, bad spawns, countless hours of setting up for the death level, and being AFK. And then I ask, do you think the LDOA title is good or bad for the hardcore Priest-Searing community? And she said, the title brings new players into the existing community, so yeah, it's a good thing. And finally, my last question was, what advice would you give to people seeking the LDOA title? And she says, try to save the majority of your quests until level 19. Any quests that you've completed will have to be made up with death leveling, meaning even if all the quests are completed, it's still possible to get to level 20. It'll just take a very long time.
Big Daddy Goose.
Greetings, extended guildies. This is Big Daddy Goose, bringing you Back to Basics. I'm very honored that Sean asked me to record this beginner's segment for the pre-searing episode of Guildcast, and I'll do my best. Now, I'm not a beginner, but I am by no means an expert. I believe this is because Guild Wars is so complex and diverse that I find it difficult to just master the basics of the game, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. So I thought this would be helpful to do a basics segment to remind the hardcore players why they love the game so much and to introduce new players. So let's get back to basics. Today, let's talk about items and inventory. Throughout your journeys in Guild Wars, you'll collect a number of items. Some you might want to trash. Some you might want to trade or sell. Some you might want to keep for a very long time. And there's a couple ways to store your items. The first is your inventory. The second is your storage account. Now, in pre-searing Ascalon, there is no storage account. So for right now, let's focus on the inventory. The inventory panel is accessed by pressing the I key on the keyboard. Inside the inventory panel, you'll see an image of your character, and to his sides, you'll see items that he's either holding or wearing, and below him, you'll see a series of bags and boxes containing items. Let's break this panel down from bottom to top. At the very bottom are the series of boxes that contain your items. These boxes are broken into storage containers. Your backpack, which is accessible by pressing F5 on the keyboard, and then you also have a belt pouch, which is accessed by F6, and two bags, accessed by F7 and F8. Now, you won't have access to your belt pouch or your two bags until you acquire these storage containers through quests. Inside your backpack, you have room for 20 items. When you acquire a belt pouch, the pouch will be able to hold 5 items. Each bag that you acquire will be able to also hold 5 items. However, you can use runes of holding, which you acquire through quests, to increase the storage capacity of these bags from 5 to 10. To access your entire inventory, all bags at the same time, press F9 on your keyboard. Any item that you do not want, for example, if you cannot sell, trade, or use the item, you can trash. To trash an item, click it and drag it to the trash icon next to your bags and release. You can also drop an item in the world by just clicking, dragging outside of your inventory. To equip an item, for example, to hold a sword or to wear a piece of armor, click that item, drag it to one of the slots next to your character's image. It's important to remember that weapons and armor are class-specific. Some items in your inventory will stack. That means you can put multiple copies of the same item in one slot. If this happens, you'll see an item with a small number in the upper left-hand corner. That number represents how many copies you have of that item. Now, only certain items are stackable. For example, you cannot have two axes that will stack on top of each other. Mainly crafting items and collectible items will stack, as well as dyes. Before we get into the items, let's finish talking about this inventory panel here. Underneath your character's image, you'll see a number with a gold piece next to it. This represents the amount of gold that your character is currently carrying. You'll also see your character has a cape with an eye icon next to it, and a headpiece with an eye icon next to it. The cape is available if you are part of a guild, and the headpiece as part of your armor. Both the cape and the headpiece are visible optionally. That means you can be wearing them, but click the eye icon to hide them so that no one can see them, including yourself. You still gain the benefits of wearing them, but they don't cramp your style. Underneath your character's image, you'll see a button marked Weapon Sets. Weapon sets allow you to remember certain weapons that are your favorites. For example, a warrior might have a weapon set of a sword and a shield, and a second weapon set of an axe and a shield, and a third weapon set of a hammer. Weapon sets are a little bit more advanced than this, so I'll save that for another segment, and I'll just focus on the basics for now. To equip weapons or armor, drag the item from the inventory space below into the appropriate slot next to your character's image. Weapons, and even focus items and shields, will go in the slots to the left of your character. Armor will go in the slots on the right of your character. Any effects that your armor or weapons will give you, such as a boost in health or energy, will take effect immediately. Equipping weapons and armor is a little bit tricky. You have to know if that weapon or armor will benefit you. You won't receive an instant message that says, this character should not be using this weapon. For example, warriors are not trained in bows. If you equip a bow to a warrior that does not have ranger as a second class, that warrior will still use the bow and will still be able to attack, but at a minimum effectiveness. So you need to know your items, you need to know the skills of your character, and you need to know how the two worked well together. These are advanced topics that we'll save for another segment. For now, let's get back to basics. Now that we've had a crash course in the inventory panel, let's talk about what will populate the inventory panel. Let's talk about the items. You will encounter a lot of items in Guild Wars. For the purposes of estimating value or worth of an item, most items will be broken down by rarity. This means when you look at an item in your inventory panel, you place your mouse over it and you see the item's description, the item will have text. The color of that text will determine the rarity. White text means it's a common, non-magical item. Most of the items you encounter will be white. Blue text means this is a common magical item. There's nothing special about it other than the fact that it gives an additional bonus. Purple text means this is an uncommon item. It's slightly more valuable. Gold text means this is a rare item. This value is even higher. Green text means this is a unique item, and these unique items will only drop from certain boss monsters in certain locations. Green items are highly sought after and very valuable. Most items can be identified. You'll know these items by a couple ways. Either the item will say unidentified in the text description, or the item will have no value. When you look at an item's description, the item will usually have a value at the bottom. This is how much a merchant is willing to pay for that item. If there is no value, this item can be identified. Identifying items requires an identification kit. These are available at most merchants. To use an identification kit, double-click on the kit, and then click on the item you want to identify. The effect is instantaneous. Sometimes you'll discover new ruins or upgrades, and you'll find that you've unlocked a certain part of the game. Some items can also be salvaged. Salvaging an item means that you break an item down into its core components. For the most part, this means you break an item down into crafting materials. But very often, you will salvage an item for a special ability. For example, some salvage items have ruins or upgrades or modifications that you can salvage from the item and apply to one of your other items. Salvaging items requires salvage kits. If you use a salvage kit on an item, you'll most often end up with some common crafting materials. However, when you use an expert salvage kit or superior salvage kit, you'll either end up with more common crafting materials, or you could end up with rare crafting materials. However, salvage kits cannot retrieve weapon upgrades or ruins from an item, nor can it salvage rare crafting materials. For those, you need the superior or expert salvage kits. Crafting materials that are salvaged from items are useful. When you go to purchase new weapons or new armor, you'll find that the weaponsmith or the armorsmith will require you to provide the crafting materials to make that new weapon or armor. You can purchase crafting materials, but it's far cheaper to use crafting materials from items that you've already won in battle. Now, not all items can be salvaged. Most items that can be salvaged will say salvage item on it. Other items that can be salvaged are usually collectible drops. Collectible drops are items that fall from monsters that you've slain that have no apparent usefulness, such as jawbones or skulls or scales. These items don't seem very useful, but they are valuable to collectors. If you take collectible drops to a collector, he will in turn give you something useful to you, such as armor or weapons or something else that's useful. Each collector only deals with a specific collectible drop. For example, jawbones will only be accepted by one collector, while another collector will only accept icy lodestones. In addition, each collector will only offer a certain reward for that collectible drop. The collector that collects lodestones, for example, may only offer weapons as a reward. Collectible drops are also useful even if you don't want to trade them into the collectors. Many players find that it's easier to buy or trade for collectible drops off other players than it is for them to go out and try to find collectible drops in battle. You can always sell your collectible drops at a merchant. You can sell it or trade it to other players. You can even salvage it for crafting materials. Or you could always just trade them into the collectors, get the reward, and then sell the reward. Now, you've heard me say upgrades and modifications and ruins. These are items that you can attach to other items in your inventory to give them additional abilities. For example, you may have a warrior who uses a sword. So he uses the attribute of swordsmanship. Through battle, he defeats a monster and the monster drops a salvage item, a piece of monster armor, which, by the way, cannot be used by characters. Anyway, the warrior then takes the salvage item and sees that it has purple text that says unidentified. You use the identification kit on the salvage item and you learn that this salvage item contains a warrior ruin of major swordsmanship, which gives your warrior a +2 in swordsmanship. To get this ruin, you would need to use the salvage kit to salvage the ruin out of the item. Once you have the ruin, double-click the ruin and click on a piece of your armor to apply the ruin. You'll see a confirmation panel that will tell you what the final armor piece will look like if you apply this ruin. You also have upgrades and modifications that you can apply to your weapons in much the same way. Speaking of weapons, I wanted to give you a brief overview of the kind of damage you should expect from your weapons. Now, in pre-searing Ascalon, most of the weapons you'll encounter will have a damage range of between 3 to 5 or 4 to 6 or some low number like that. You should always be on the lookout for weapons that have higher damage range. But you should also be aware that there is a max damage range that weapons will not go above. You should keep your eyes out for these weapons. For warrior, the axe will have a maximum damage of 6 to 28. The hammer will have a maximum damage of 19 to 35, and the sword will have a max damage of 15 to 22. For the ranger, any bow should have a maximum damage of 15 to 28. For all spellcasters, their staffs and wands should have a maximum damage of 11 to 22. Now once again, these are not damage ranges that you should be able to find in weapons in pre-Searing Ascalon, but it's a good idea to keep your eyes out for them. Finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about dyes. Now, Sean did an amazing episode one time on dyes and how to use dyes. The dye system has slightly evolved since then, and it is a little bit more advanced than I'm willing to talk about here. But I would like to mention that dyes are a very collectible item by players. Players love to customize their armor and their weapons with their own colors. And since dyes can be mixed, players can create their own colors if they have the right dyes. Dyes tend to drop more frequently in pre-Searing Ascalon only because the amount of other weapons that drop in pre-Searing Ascalon are dramatically reduced. What I mean by this is, anywhere you go in the game, there's a random chance of any one of 1,000 items dropping. However, to keep the game balanced and to keep items and characters in a low-level state in pre-Searing Ascalon, they have limited the amount of items that drop. Dyes are still dropped in pre-Searing Ascalon, so the chance of finding a dye is much greater. Well, I think I've spoken about as much as Sean will let me. I would love to come back and do some more Back to Basics. Thank you for listening, and this has been
Big Daddy Goose.
Hey all, this is Lady Sinea bringing you the word on the street. I can't believe that I forgot to mention April Fool's Day to you the last time I spoke to you. Well, basically what happened was, when you went into Lion's Arch, Xing Jie, or Kamadon, your character's gender was reversed as a joke. I went and looked at the character creation screen to figure out how it was determined. And basically, if you went and made a female Alonian Necro, for instance, and you chose face number 1 and hair number 2, your character was remade as a male Alonian Necro with face number 1 and hair number 2. Simple, but clever. Some of us entertained ourselves that day by taking screenshots of all of our characters. What I found most interesting, though, was seeing what your character's armor looks like on the opposite sex. Yeah, I know that you can just go look it up on the wiki, but it's interesting when you see that it really is your armor. Because, for instance, I have sets that are mixed and matched. Like my ranger, she's got all FOW armor except for the pants. Instead, she's got the 15K studded leather skirt, which is totally cute and even dyes well to match the other pieces. And it totally looks like it belongs with that set. Well, anyway, the male ranger's 15K studded leather leggings just didn't go as well with the FOW armor. And for my Necro, she's another one that's got a mix. She's got the Canthan armor, and her skirt is the 1.5K Luxon. On the female, it's a really cool-looking combo, but on the male, it's a little lacking. Okay, and then I had my Ellie in Xing Jie armor with the tiny little skirt, and it's dyed a sort of reddish-purpley kind of color. Well, transfer that really girly purple color onto the equivalent male armor, and yeah, the result was pretty frightening. Actually, all of my characters looked pretty freaky after they were gender-switched, except for Kane. A lot of people tried to tell me that he looked better as a girl, but I tried to ignore them. I do have to say that the ancient armor on female mesmers is nowhere near as awesome as the male version. I get a lot of compliments on that armor. Maybe it's because not a lot of people have it or something. But yeah, with the jacket and all, I think it's definitely the most rugged looking of the male Mesmer armors. But, I hate to admit it, but Kane really did make a very cute little Tyrion girl. Poor guy, though. After his transformation, he was so confused he didn't know what to do. He didn't know whether he ought to feel himself up first, or he should go and try out some of his old pickup lines on the locals and see if he could pick up some guys. Well, fortunately, April 1st was over before he had to decide that, and he was able to go back to his normal routine of fancying himself as a ladies' man. And all order was restored in the universe. Oh, okay. Now, speaking of my Mesmer's prowess, I was in AB some weeks ago, and me and Cal and a couple of Sean's guildies were grouped together, and we were getting set up to start. And someone in town was like, "Hey, Lady Sinead," in local chat. Now, usually when I'm on a different character, I don't get recognized in towns, so I was like, "Hello, who's there?" Anyway, it was Dark Grindelwald, who I'd spoken to before, and Nervala Drakon. Nervala didn't say much, but he did ask to be mentioned. And then, after they left, I told Cal, I was like, "Those two Guildcast listeners were totally mesmerized by my masculinity." And, he disagreed with me. I don't know why. And then there was another person that I spoke to recently, and it was kind of under amusing circumstances that he whispered me. He talked to me the other day, and it was under a different character name than one that I had known him as. But it was a very clever name. His name was A Pet Elder Wolf, and he said, "Hey, I doubt you remember me, but I was an Earth Ellie in AB, and I heard you talk about me in the podcast." And I was like, "Really? Cool. Were you the guy who was running Mystic Regen? I didn't know you were a listener." And he was like, "Well, I wasn't at the time." And he was telling me about how he started listening to the show, and he heard me talking, and he was like, "Hey, that sounds familiar." And then as it went on, it was like, "That's too weird." And then he was like, "Whoa, that's me, definitely." So I thought that was a hilarious coincidence. I'll bet that was quite a surprise to be listening to a show and then realizing that the person really is talking about you. So, I guess it really is a small world after all. Now, I'm sure that there are more people who asked to be mentioned in the past couple of months, and I'm really sorry if I've missed you. Again. I swear I'm gonna tape a piece of paper to my desk or something and write down your quests as soon as I get them. Something so that I don't forget. I swear, I promise, I will. Okay, now, here's some fun news. As I'm recording this, my ranger has just had her second birthday, and she got a baby juggernaut. It is really cute, with its little battle stance and everything. It turns out that my warrior is also just one day younger, so she just got a baby thorn wolf. So, that's kind of cool. My monk is gonna be next. Probably in the next couple of weeks, because she's reading as 23 months old right now. And then my necro is 21, so I can't wait to see what else I'm going to get. Of course, my Ellie and my Mez, after they hit their one-year marks, they got recreated onto my primary account, so they're going to miss out since they're too young. And I'm not going to go into this extensively right now, but so long as I'm on the topic of how I had to recreate my characters, all I'm going to say is that if there's no way to track both of my accounts in Eye of the North or Guild Wars 2, I'm going to be very, very displeased. But anyway, I have two more presents to look forward to, so woohoo! This should be fun. I have way too many mini pets, though, seriously. Spread across about 7 characters, I hadn't really known how many pets I actually had, but after gathering them all together, I find that they take up more than 1.5 blocks of storage space. So I'm going to start getting rid of some of them, at least the duplicates. And I'm not sure, but I might also start selling the white ones too, but I haven't decided yet. I guess it'll depend on what you're able to get recognized for or what you can take with you in the Hall of Monuments. I read the PC Gamer article, and there were some things that were talking about, like, it sounded like you could take items, but I don't really see how you can do that. So I'm waiting to find some official word on whether physical objects like weapons or something can be brought into Guild Wars 2, because that would be interesting. But I've started liquidating a lot of the stuff I have into cash. Basically, I looked at what we know for sure is going to carry over in the Hall of Monuments, and although we really don't know very much, the PC Gamer article did say titles such as Kind of a Big Deal will carry over. So now that I have 7 max titles due to the skill capping being added there, I want to get 3 more so that I can have people know me. Thanks to Loudon for hooking me onto Sunspear Farming, I'm rather close to finishing Legendary Spear Marshal, so that will make 8, and then the next one that I'm going to go for is Connoisseur of Confectionaries. I don't really know how I'm going to do that. I'm very close to level 1 right now, and do have a bunch of sugar items that I haven't used yet, but if I were to only buy red bean cakes, it would cost me another 1.8 million gold to get from tier 1 to tier 2. So, yeah, that's why I've been selling stuff. I've got a lot of junk that I'm sure is worth something, but it's just not in liquid assets. So, the first thing I did was took a look at my material storage. I've just been collecting materials just because I'm like, look, I have a full material storage. So I have at least one of everything, but I've also gathered like 250 of a lot of the easy to craft rare materials. So one evening, as I was just chatting in the guild hall, I was just standing at the rare material trader and clicking forever, and I unloaded pretty much all of my ink, steel, leather, Alonian leather, Deldramore steel, monstrous fangs, vellum, parchment, and I think that's it. But I kept track of all the things and how much it came out to, and by the end of selling all that, I had quote-unquote made about 150k. And that's not even including the expensive stuff like ecto shards and gems, which I would want to sell to players, because I could probably get a little more profit out of that. But, you know, I looked at it and said, I'm never going to use this stuff, because I've already got armor for all of my characters, so why am I just storing this stuff? So, my poor materials collection is crying, but my pocketbook is happily getting fatter. I have so much junk accumulated that I don't use. Like, why the heck does my warrior have all of these extra swords, like Victo's Blade, and all these green hammers, when she always just uses the same IDS of Fortitude, or Victo's Battle Axe with Thorgal's Shield or Grognar's Defender? Or why do I have a zillion extra green bows when my ranger always uses the same 4 all the time? She's got Drago's Flatbow, Elswith's Recurve, a Zealous Stormbow, and a Sundering Shortbow of Enchanting. I don't really need anything else, except for the occasional elemental bowstring, but those are cheap and easy to come by. So I should just get rid of all of these different green vampiric bows that I have that I'm not putting on heroes, because they just, like, degen themselves. And they're just taking up space, so I'm just going to sell them. But you get the idea. I'll spare you the blow-by-blow descriptions of my other characters and Ragos, Flints, Galagords, Brones, Kepkets, and, you know, others' weapons. And I'll also refrain from pointing out how patriotic I am by using Tyrian greens. Oh, sorry. Did I mention that just now? My bad. But anyway, I'm going to start liquidating all of this stuff to buy sugar. So if anyone's got sugar items for sale, I will gladly buy them from you. If you've got bulk, great, I'll buy them all. Although I play my Monk and my Mesmer the most these days, those two being the only ones that I've gotten through all 3 chapters, I'm thinking about stripping all of the heroes of my other characters of their weapons for more cash, but I'm not totally ready to let go of the characters themselves yet, though. But, you know, going down this train of thought, I did seriously consider just dropping Guild Wars entirely until Eye of the North comes out, because, well, I'll tell you. I was just as excited as everyone else when Hard Mode came out. Maybe even more excited. I had been waiting with bated breath to do all of my favorite Ascalonian missions with worthy opponents. When Hard Mode came out, I went straight to the Great Northern Wall, and then from there, proceeded to Fort Rannoch. We had a guild group in Rannoch, and we had a ranger, two casters, and me healing, and we got stomped, and I was like, ow, we need a tank. So Fire offered to go get his warrior, but I didn't think he really wanted to, so I was like, nah, let's just have you bring your pet, and we'll let it tank. So we talked it over, and we tweaked our builds a little bit, and then we went for it again, and we did complete it with the bonus at the end. And I was having a blast. I was, like, looking for cover so that I could hide from the Charstalker's line of sight while healing our little pet tank from around the corner. And I was just loving it. I was having so much fun, and I was whispering my friend about how awesome Hard Mode was. And then he didn't say much, but he said something about the solo farming nerf and how he felt about it. And my spirits just went plummeting. For some people, solo farming is what they do. You might say, well, this is just gonna force those antisocial bastards into team farming or actually playing the game for once. Yeah, you could say that, but don't you realize some people don't care about the missions or quests? The farming nerf wasn't forcing those players to change their playstyle. It was alienating them completely. So, I felt sick. I knew that if something wasn't changed, my friend was going to quit playing Guild Wars. And I don't know if anyone else saw it, but I knew the gravity of what this meant to his Guild Wars experience. I was ready to just throw in the towel and wait until Eye of the North came out. I already had kind of a big deal, so whatever. I had something that I would be able to take along with me to the Hall of Monuments. It's not like I had anything else I wanted to do particularly. Not even killing Char was able to cheer me up, and that's saying something. What would be the point of having the brave heroine hanging around to save the day if her archenemy wasn't around to banter with anymore? Who would pester me while I was trying to do a mission? Who would bother me with personalized poems such as this masterpiece? Roses are red, violets are blue. This poem doesn't rhyme, you suck. I laughed so hard when he sent that to me. This is the kind of things that I do while playing Guild Wars. It's like, these little things make the whole gaming experience worthwhile. Oh, and speaking of Loudon, his monk recently hit 10 million experience. He has, like, doubled his EXP in the time that it's taken me to go from 5 million to 6. So, I just wanted to say congratulations to him for that. But anyway, wise decision, ArenaNet, for backpedaling a bit on that farming nerf. But I was so distraught for that one day or so that all of my excitement about Hard Mode was completely quenched. I wish it wasn't true. I wish that I loved Hard Mode with a passion, and that I could rave about how awesome it was for the next 5 episodes. But I can't. I just don't give a crap about it anymore. Sorry to depress you, but I guess you get a double dose of Lady Sinea ranting since you got a break from it last episode. You had the extreme opposite from me during episode 68. Now, I promised you that I'd tell you a bit about the automated tournament system beta. Well, I participated in the testing of hero battles, and then last week they also tested GVG. I really wanted to do that as well, but it was going to be even more hours than the previous week, and Since I'm in the same time zone as these guys, them doing the testing during their business hours is also right in the middle of my workday, so I just couldn't afford to lose any more time at work. So I had to pass on that. But basically, each day, there was a window of time when we had to register for the tournament, and then it would match you up with someone, and based on whether you won or lost, it would determine who you fight next. So one loss didn't mean that you were out. It would just track your win-loss ratio and rank you accordingly. And basically, we just played so that the servers would have the game load on them all the time, and we would just report any bugs that we came across during the day. But it was a lot of fun. I made my account name Loudon's Arch Nemesis. My account name on Live is Lady Sinea, but I'm thinking about changing that one too. Not that I've done many hero battles on Live, because I was so sick of having to play 12 to 15 hours of hero battles that week that I haven't played any since. But one interesting highlight that was of note for me was when I clicked on the OK button or whatever it was when I was getting set up for the next round. It said that I was going to be playing Avatar of Izzy. And I was on TeamSpeak at the time, and I was like, what? I'm playing Avatar of Izzy? I was like, that's got to be someone else. There's no way. I am so not playing a dev. But it turned out that I was. I ended up playing Rose of Izzy. And I don't know if he was trying out a new build or something, or maybe I'm just better than I thought I was, but I was a little behind at first when we first started the round, and then I caught up, and I was like, woot, we're tied 10-10. And of course, since Cal was bothering me, keeping me company on TeamSpeak, he told me that I'm still a noob and I was going to lose anyway. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate the words of encouragement. You're going to be in big trouble when I see you. But he was right. I lost, but it wasn't bad. It was only like 15 to 20 at the end, so that was kind of cool. I got to play a hero battle against a dev. You don't get to do that every day. Another cool thing that happened was that after the first day's testing was done, the test server was still up, and we got to hang out and chat with Gale. We had some really funny conversations, and I screenshot some of it. I should really post what I have on the Guildcast forums. But at one point she said, "Hey, small group, I want to ask you something. Give it some thought. It's hard for me to get this info in a large town. Thinking back over your whole Guild Wars experience, and I know that not all of you may have all games, if you were to choose one region, not game, but a region within a game, as your favorite, what would it be?" There were a few responses of Shiver Peaks, and I think one person said Vabi, another said Fire Islands, but Pre-Searing was overwhelmingly the answer everyone came out with. So then Gale said, "So, just us talking now, if I were to take that to the designers and say that you love Pre-Searing so much, would it be fair to say that somewhere in Guild Wars 2 it would be splendid to have such an area?" So our response was, well, yes, of course, but I had skepticism as to how that would ever fit the storyline or how they could get that kind of feeling into Guild Wars 2. But she said, you know, this wasn't super secret or anything, it was just us chatting, and she wanted to get some player thoughts. So I piped up and started telling her about why some of us love prophecies. Others chimed in as well to echo the sentiments, and someone along the line said, "Give us another prophecies!" But I tried to point out specifics about what it was that we liked so much. So then she asked, "But would you say, of all, that prophecies, for those of you who have all three, is the one with which you're most emotionally connected?" We all said yes, definitely, and I said that Prophecies was the only one where I truly felt drawn into the storyline. You know, Nightfall is a great game, but honestly, when your character says, "Koss, she's a Corsair, can we trust her?" Did any of you really care that she was a Corsair? Did you? I didn't care. So, I said that with factions and Nightfall, I didn't really feel like I was part of the game. So then Gale said, "Interesting. I would have thought that that is what you would say. Is it because it was the first, or other reasons?" So I said, no, I don't think that we liked Prophecies the most because it was the first. Yes, I'll grant that with the way the chapters work and had to cater to both new and established players, Nightfall is actually a better constructed game. But with Prophecies, I can still go back and play it over and over again and love it as much as I did the first time, so I doubt that it's all nostalgia. One person said that they liked the Northern Shiver Peaks the best, and said that Factions and Nightfall didn't have enough snow, to which Gale replied, I see, snowy areas appeal. I believe then that Eye of the North may appeal. So there's a little insider tidbit for you, something about snow and Eye of the North. But I also wanted to point out that that person who said that he loved the Shiver Peaks, here's also something that he commented on. When first asked which area he liked the best, he said, "The one I love the most? Northern Shiver Peaks. Leading your broken people across the mountains to freedom has a certain appeal to it." So, ha! I am not the only player out there who's got that Ascalonian pride and who doesn't play Frostgate just to laugh when Rurik dies. Apparently, I'm not the only sentimental git out there. But yeah, as for pre-searing, I hadn't really explored much of it in a really long time. Even though I remade my Ellie and my Mesmer not too many months ago, I know the quests so well that I just blasted through everything to get the most experience in the most efficient fashion there, and, you know, survive without dying through the academy, etc. So I didn't actually go, like, look around very much, but somewhat recently, Loudon and I made a couple of pre-searing characters, and although we haven't gotten very far with it, I've actually done a little bit more exploring in places recently, and, looking in places that I'm sure I haven't seen in, like, 2 years. Like, back behind the wall. You can just run in there and do your quick little quest and be done and get out. But I was back there, and the person I was with was like, let's go to Piken. And I was like, okay. Well, that area is totally devoid of anything of any particular interest in pre, so I hadn't really given it any thought. But now, having spent a bunch of time in post, of course, I go and look around there, and I was like, whoa, this is Piken! Duh, I should have realized that. And I was checking out, like, the big effigies of Titans that are hanging out near the char camps, and I don't think I ever noticed those, and I certainly didn't recognize them for what they were back when my 6 characters were in pre. And there are other really obvious landmarks, like Ashford Abbey and the Sanitarium, and I used that spot right outside of that outpost in my Monk Ascension video to show what it looked like before the searing and after. But if you look closer, there are a lot of other not-so-obvious places. We were back behind the wall, and I ran up to a dead end and was like, oh, man, this is where you run to meet up with Callahan. And then I went back down the path and saw, like, this is the route where you run from the char in the Great Northern Wall. And all through this, I'm looking at these very familiar yet eerily pristine locations, and it was so beautiful, but it was making me so sad. So I haven't played my pre-searing character very much since then, because it's, like, painful. But, this reminds me of a video that a guildie of mine showed me. This video, it looks like a movie. It is so well put together. It's, like, 15 minutes long, and in this video, they took a bunch of shots of pre versus post to show how the landscape had changed and everything during the searing, and the way they did it is just seamless. It's very well done, and it shows, like, this one leader step up and everyone, like, pledges their fealty, and it's so cool to watch the despair of these broken people suddenly change as they all get armored and put their capes on, and this guild is formed in the wake of the searing. And there's also this side story where a warrior comes home to his demolished land, and he thinks his girlfriend got killed. So he goes on this killing rampage against the Char, and the whole thing is just so passionate and so amazing. I cried the whole way through it. So, yeah, maybe I'm just a stupid sentimental girl, but you go watch it for yourself and tell me what you think. That guild, it looks like they're spread across multiple games, but man, they had some serious guild pride to make a video like that. So let me just give you the URL for this. It's www.gametrailers.com/umwatcher.php?UPID=128. So go check it out and tell me what you think. I also wanted to say thank you for all of the feedback from episode 68. I am glad that you all liked it. I've gotten everything from I'm glad I've never had to go through what you have, to I'm thankful that I have a good guild, to you made me want to be a better officer. There was one bit of feedback that I got, though, which kind of stood out. He didn't ask to be mentioned or anything, but I'm going to read part of what he wrote as a simple comment that he left on a blog entry that I wrote. And he said, "Lady Sinea, I must thank you personally for what you said in episode 68. Your words have touched me on a much deeper level than I can express. Everything you've said, from horror stories of past guild experiences and thinking about quitting guild wars, all the way to how a good guild should be, as well as how a good leader should be, all resonated very strongly within me. We seem to share many of the same values in pretty much all of these areas, and it made me happy that someone else sees things the way I do. I've been through a lot with my guild. Unfortunately, most of it has been pretty bad. We were very happy and prosperous in the beginning, but somewhere down the line, real-life commitments reared their ugly heads. Several members have come and gone throughout the lifespan of this guild. There were good times and bad. Sadly, at this point, the bad have outweighed the good. I haven't truly played the game in over a month. Your words have changed that mindset for me. What you said really means a lot to me, and although thank you does not come close to justifying what you've done for me, thank you, Lady Sinea. Thank you for reminding me why I became a citizen of Tyria in the first place, and why I should continue to be a citizen of Tyria. I wish you all the best in your endeavors. This has been Narsikin Grey, leader of the Circle of the Moon, and you've brought me much more than the word on the street." And with that, I'm left speechless, and I think I'm going to go cry again. So excuse me, this has been Lady Sinea bringing you the word on the street.
So that'll do it for another episode of Guildcast. I hope this episode inspired a few people to create a new character in pre-searing. It might be something cool to do, you know, before the next expansion comes out later this year. I'm working on a few different possibilities for the next episode, so I don't want to announce that just yet. But until then, be sure to tell your friends and tell your guildmates about guildcast.com.